Okay, so shall I start with the bottom line?
Please.
Okay, you know that in the vicinity of the Bose-Einstein condensation point, or it's better to say in the vicinity of the normal to superfluid transition point, because the properties of the transition are universal and do not depend whether we are dealing with weakly interacting Bose gas or, say, superfluid helium. In the vicinity of this point, all our perturbative approaches fail. And actually, we would like to have some accurate description of the system, of the situation. And my talk will be about how you can arrive at this description numerically. And the bottom line is now everything is solved. Okay? This is the bottom line. All the answers are there. Okay? And if something is not solved just for some reason, it can be.
What's the definition by solving?
What do you mean by solving? All curves, all constants, all numbers are there. Okay, all plots, you will see them. Okay, so this is the bottom line, and now just some details on how we can do that. If you mean theorists, well, if you can produce some theory in terms of non-trivial summation of diagrams, it would be just great for you to compare your prediction with.
If I produce a theory with a trivial summation of diagrams.
And it will coincide with our data, you will get a Nobel Prize.
We have a prediction that can be compared with experiment.
Yeah.
What happens if the experiment disagrees with this prediction?
Well, actually, I don't know. I hope it will agree. And actually, I will see just what could be measured experimentally. You will see that actually the interaction is, in terms of fluctuation region, the interaction which typical experiment deals with is not that small at all. And I'll show you some plot, some interesting plot. Okay, so this is the work. Actually, it's a series of papers with my permanent co-author Nikolai Prokofiev and Oliver Rubinacker, who is a student who helped us in this particular work. Our numeric studies were aimed at description of a critical point and its vicinity in two-dimensional and three-dimensional gases. We started with just defining critical parameters, like critical temperature and 2D and 3D critical value of chemical potential. Then we considered two-dimensional gas in the vicinity of the Coster-Stawlitz transition. And now we are ready with the results for three-dimensional case. So the outline of my talk is as follows. First of all, I would like to discuss some physics, because actually, apart from a purely numerical challenge to produce some non-perturbative results, it's quite an interesting physics, because basically it's the physics of classical field. We are used to the fact that Bose-Einstein condensate behaves like a classical field, which we describe with Gross-Peter-Yevsky equation. But actually, the classical field physics starts much earlier. It starts even prior to the appearance of Bose-Einstein condensate. And we know from the theory of second-order phase transitions that basically finite temperature, second-order phase transition are all classical. They are described by this or that classical field. And Bose-Einstein condensation is just the most typical phenomena of that sort, because classical field description arises here at microscopic level. We just do not need to introduce some collective variable, an order parameter. Order parameter arises here naturally at a microscopic level, and that's what I am going to discuss. Then we will see that actually the behavior of weakly interacting Bose gas is in a sense universal, not in the sense of critical universality, but in a sense of much wider universality of so-called weakly interacting U1 systems. And it gives us a tool to solving the problem. Then I will introduce basic scaling variables and functions, which we would like to calculate numerically. I will briefly discuss the numeric algorithm. It's our original WOM algorithm. Then I will present the results. And then I'm going to show some plot which we would like to see reproduced experimentally, which will demonstrate the importance of non-perturbative effects. Then I will describe the condition of weakness of interaction. And finally, I would like to discuss an issue which is not necessarily related to the critical region, but it's important in the vicinity of the critical region. Namely, I will be claiming that even in three-dimensional case, when we have a genuine condensate, the description in terms of so-called quasi-condensate, which we use in two dimensions, is much, much better. I will show just the numeric proof of that. Okay, so what do we have in a weakly interacting Bose gas when we approach critical region? This is the scale. The scale of wave vectors. And what is important is that if we compare the temperature, typical temperature wave vector, with a typical wave vector at which we see some non-perturbative behavior, we will see that this wave vector, let us call it mode coupling wave vector, the wave vector at which harmonics start to strongly interact. This Kc is much smaller than Kt, thermal wave vector, which immediately implies that we can subdivide, that we can cut the system into two characteristic pieces. One piece is a kind of trivial. We have a non-interacting harmonics. Doesn't matter whether they are classical or quantum, they do not interact, and that's why they can be easily described. When a wave vector is on the order of Kt, is on the order of Kt or larger, all harmonics are quantized. If wave vector is much smaller than Kt, we have a large occupation numbers, and correspondingly, we have a classical field description. And this gives us immediately an idea how we can approach the problem. Because basically, all the physics of the phase transition deals with this region. When wave vectors are of the order of this Kc, Kc or smaller, which means that we can just cut off and remove the rest of the system. It plays just a role of heat bath, which is not at all important for the criticality. And the rest of the system can be described just by time-dependent Gross-Pitayevsky equation. Yeah?
What is the definition of Kc?
It has nothing to do with, first of all, it's a good question, and I would like to make a remark. Just if something is not clear, immediately interrupt me, like Zora did, okay? Just do not hesitate. Okay. Okay. You have harmonics which obey this equation. If wave vector is large enough, these harmonics are almost independent. Like random phase approximation, they do not interact. The kinetic energy corresponding to the harmonics is much larger than potential energy of interaction. To the first approximation, they do not interact at all. To the second approximation, they interact and lead to kinetic equation. You can describe them kinetically. Here you describe the behavior of harmonics kinetically. But you know that under certain conditions, when you approach critical region, you see that long wave harmonics start to interact significantly. The potential energy of interaction is on the order of kinetic energy. And this happens at some scale of momentum Kc. That's what I mean by Kc. Momentum at which harmonics start to interact significantly.
So is Kc roughly the inverse of the zero temperature healing rate?
No, because healing length is defined in terms of total density. Uh-huh. And Kc, I can use the formula for the healing length, but then instead of the total density, I should to plug in some effective density, and then you will be right. It's a
condensate density?
No, because it's But it's a good question. It's actually on my next transparency, I will make some estimates, and you will see that actually only small portion of the total density participates in criticality. The rest of the density is a kind of non-universal contribution which is associated with the particular details of the particular system. And only a small portion of density is universal. And in terms of this small portion, you are absolutely right. The numeric estimate will look like Hilling length, but not with respect to the total density. See? Okay. And what is important in terms of this classical description as that in this case we have some cutoff. Our field should have some cutoff. Otherwise, the system will be ill-defined because you know that classical field does not feature well-defined statistics. It's so-called ultraviolet catastrophe.
That equation, an operator or a C number?
It's C number. It's classical field. And this is the analogy with electromagnetic fields. It's an analog of Maxwell equation.
Yeah.
Classical Maxwell equation in the electromagnetic field.
Okay, but then that equation is not exact. Absolutely.
The corrections are of the order of 1 over nk, and nk is much larger than unity.
So this is valid in this classical, in the strongest.
Yeah. This equation is valid here. So this is the idea. Here, to the first approximation, asymptotically, just it's the leading term. We have this classical field description, like with
large occupation numbers of the
Absolutely. Just keep in mind the example of equilibrium electromagnetic field. If we have, for example, in this room, equilibrium electromagnetic field, the longest harmonics are classical because they correspond to large occupation numbers. We can use Maxwell equation to describe them. With weakly interaction.
Classical Maxwell equation.
You can use Maxwell equation to describe just the wave function of a photon. I mean when you use that you can use Maxwell equation to describe all the physics. There is no physics going beyond Maxwell equation. When the number of photons, when the occupation number of a photon is much larger than unity, just the standard condition when you can go from quantum description of electromagnetic field in terms of photons in the description in terms of just vector potential or whatever, which behaves like a classical field. Quantization is irrelevant. And occupation numbers are much larger than unity. Normally, the occupation, the quantization is irrelevant, provided there is some uncertainty much larger than unity, but normally it's the case when we are dealing with statistics.
Well,
yeah?
There clearly some circumstances where this is not right. For example, I mean, if we try to apply this description, for example, to the quenching process, in which we're actually forming a condensate out of an uncondensed system, it's going to fail badly because
it's perfect. It works perfect.
Well, let me make you the following challenge. Can you define actually define it in terms of the many particle wave function without using the notion of spontaneously broken symmetry?
For this purpose, I would prefer to work not with the wave function but with density matrix, because I will use the representation of density matrix in terms of coherent states. I will show that this density matrix is diagonal in terms of coherent states, and I will show that each coherent state in my density matrix evolves along the classical trajectory.
Representation?
It's not the Wigner representation, it's just the representation of coherent states. I can show it, but basically it's a very well-known fact in the theory of electromagnetic radiation, that once you have large occupation numbers and there is some uncertainty larger than unity in your occupation numbers, so that it's important that you are dealing with a density matrix, not just exact wave function. It's important.
Okay, let's do it the other way around. Okay.
Excuse me?
Let's start at zero temperature, right, where you would agree that we would have a wave function.
Yeah.
Now, define your psi in terms of that wave function.
It's impossible to define psi in terms of wave function because to introduce classical description, as always, even if I have this pointer, okay, and if you will describe it with the wave function, it will be in the ground state. It will be delocalized over this room, okay. So to describe the pointer in terms of a coordinate and an angle, I need somehow, I cannot work with the wave function.
That's not true.
It's true.
It's a perfectly good wave function which describes that point.
There is, but it's not the ground state wave function.
No,
it's a wave packet.
No, good. Yeah, good. It's a wave packet.
It's a wave packet.
It's, you can construct a wave packet.
Okay.
So, of course, I can construct a wave packet which will correspond.
Okay.
Yeah, and this wave packet is known as coherent state. Basically, the wave packet which corresponds to this is the coherent state.
Define it for me in terms of the many-body wave function. That's all I'm asking.
You mean coordinate wave function? It's just not good representation because many body wave function can be represented in second quantization.
Oh, okay. I don't want to. I'm just provoking.
It's not easy to do in coordinate
representation. Yeah. You would be very skeptical about this problem.
We can solve the problem in two steps, from coordinate representation by second quantization. I hope you have nothing against second quantization.
No, there's
okay. We use second quantization. We introduce coherent states. We introduce corresponding wave packets, and so on, and we are done.
So is it something kind of what they call in quantum the P of alpha representation?
Excuse me.
No, are you using the P of alpha?
I do not know the terminology, but basically it was shown by Glauber that you can introduce coherent states which correspond to the wave packets which describe classical field states of a quantum field. Yeah.
I thought we move on. We've been around the second transparency.
Yeah.
We haven't seen the substance yet. So we're discussing.
Maybe let me ask to see if we agree what he said. So basically, there's a logarithmic k is your axis, yes?
Yeah.
Then kt is somewhat the Bluey wavelength.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So for energy scales less than that, clearly you have a macroscopic occupation, yes?
Yeah.
What you are saying is there's this KC. Is this KC related to the Fonon region?
No, nothing to do with Fonon region.
So the next
Nothing to do. Because in the fluctuation regions, Fonons are ill-defined. You do not have Fonons. You have Fonons when you have a good condensate. And on top of that, you have Fonons. In the fluctuation regions, there is strong scattering. They are overdamped. All phonons are overdamped. There are no phonons. All the physics is non-perturbative. No phonons, no good elementary excitations whatsoever. Just some messy state.
But clearly, I could plot this same thing at different temperatures, yes? If I say...
It's a good question. It's a good question. If your temperature is large enough, you should recall about chemical potential. Because your chemical potential will become negative and large. And you will not have any region with large occupation numbers. Okay? So your temperature should be low enough to guarantee the region with large occupation numbers. So it's a good question. It's the difference with electromagnetic field, where chemical potential is always zero because the total number of phonons is not conserved. And we always have the region of classical field. In the quantum gas, We will have this region only when temperature is low enough. Okay, when we are pretty close to the TC, when TC minus T is much smaller than TC itself. Okay?
So what if we move to the next slide?
Okay, so the next slide is about the estimate. But maybe I'll give you just another idea how we see explicitly and rigorously the classical field. If you just do the perturbation theory, Beliaev diagrammatic technique, you will see that the dangerous diagrams, the only dangerous diagrams correspond to zero frequency. The rest is just perturbative. And zero frequency is nothing else than the classical field.
And you're talking now about thermal equilibrium.
I'm discussing only thermal equilibrium. But I'm just would be glad to discuss kinetics as well. Okay, but not right away. Okay. Okay. So this is how we do our estimates. And the most important thing is the universality of weakly interacting U1 systems, the systems that feature global U1 symmetry. If we compare just four different systems, just our conventional Bose gas, or weakly interacting bosons on a lattice, or continuous classical field with ultraviolet cutoff, or lattice classical field which doesn't need any cutoff because it's discrete, we will see that actually the behavior, the criticality of these systems is one and the same, because we always can have the situation is basically the definition of what we mean by weakly interacting U1 model. Then we have a region where all these models are described by this effective Hamiltonian. It's one and the same for all models. And it doesn't matter what M is, either it's a bare mass or effective mass or just some coefficient. But what is the microscopic origin of this contact interaction and this effective chemical potential? So all these models behave similarly. All the models of these properties are one and the same in this region. They differ in this region, but the difference is trivial because here we have non-interacting harmonics, which can be easily taken into account perturbatively. So basically, the idea of our approach is to cut the system into two pieces to simulate this region in terms of the simplest system that we can simulate. And the simplest system will be the lattice classical field. And then I will explain you why. And then we are done, because here everything is solved just by perturbation theory, by diagrammatic technique, or whatever perturbation theory I would like to use. So now we need to make three important estimates. First of all, we need to estimate the value of this Kc in our models in terms of the parameters of the effective Hamiltonian. And we do it as follows. We understand that if we, just for the sake of making an estimate, take the limit when this K prime, which is the momentum of our cutoff, is on the order of Kc, you can immediately figure out that the criticality, that the fluctuation region corresponds to the situation when all the three terms in this effective action are of one and the same order. We also understand that for the purpose of just estimating typical value, we can approximate, roughly approximate the system as non-interacting or interacting perturbatively classical field. So that's why we just use this pretty standard expression for the occupation numbers. And we end up with the following estimate. We introduce the effective density, which corresponds to this region, to these harmonics. And in terms of this effective density, we have these relations. And you can easily check that in terms of the effective density, Kc is indeed a kind of Hilling length. So.
Since these are the only modes, if you want, which are significantly excited, right?
They are significantly entangled, interacting, nonlinear.
Okay, I thought
the rest of the system is also excited.
But very weakly, right?
No. It's excited just properly.
I mean, is it macroscopically populated?
These ones, yeah, not microscopically. These modes, none of the modes is populated macroscopically. The occupation number can be large, say 10 or 100, but it's not a macroscopic number. Okay, it's a kind of turbulent classical field. We do not have condensate. It's a kind of turbulence.
But still, occupation is much larger than one.
Absolutely. 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 It's the crucial point that occupation numbers are much larger than one. They are much larger than one once we are here. Once K is much larger than typical cutoff. So there.
On the right hand side, they are of the order of one.
Actually, for some system, for the Bose gas, they are on the order of one. For lattice system, lattice classical system, or continuous classical system, the notion of one or just non-one is irrelevant because they are continuous. Okay,
but yeah. At this point, that psi is macroscopically occupied, and the other one could be ln of k times.
But
there is in fact one mole.
Okay.
Is macroscopically occupied. Is that right?
You could put it this way. So for each time moment, we can find one mode which is macroscopically occupied, but this mode evolves in time.
One mode of the order of square root n, the other one can be much larger than one, but not yet of square root n. Is that what you're saying?
You can put it this way, but
my question, I guess, was how different is n tilde from n?
It can differ arbitrarily depending on the weakness of interaction. It can be 1%, it can be 1,000 or whatever. N tilde has nothing to do with the total density. It's important. N tilde is expressed only in terms of the parameters of this effective action. And it has nothing to do with the total density. No, n tilde has nothing to do with the total density.
You know, actually, this nk is a bridge height on the psi. He wasn't talking about another kind. This object has corrections, as we talk about. And all those corrections due to the quantum nature of higher order modes.
Yeah.
But you are now talking about the Fourier transform of this object and not talking about all the other stuff. Right?
Absolutely. We are estimating, we have three crucial parameters. We have just external parameters like m, t, and u, and we have internal parameters like kc, effective density, which is the square of the absolute value of our cavity, and our effective chemical potential, which means that we take a genuine chemical potential and we subtract all perturbative contributions. And this is the rest, when we subtract all perturbative contributions to the chemical potential.
So the answer is classical Hilbertian factor in space and time. You just say this is how things fluctuate.
No, I'm just confused because I thought that the cutoff was determined by the point below which, up to the left of it, you were allowed to treat the field more or less classically.
Yeah, but it's just the way how I produce estimates. This cutoff in practice can be just everywhere.
And his criterion is that only when all the modes quote unquote interacting strongly, i.e. all the kinetic energy, potential energy for this classical mode, they all interacting, then he lump it all together into one field and one classical field, and then could go per psi, which has many momentum components in it. And then hopefully, I think Tony's question is valid. I mean, I know you don't like it, but then it is true that suppose I'm just trying to do things. Since you agree that you address equilibrium value issue, so there's an issue how this relates to the wave function. But let's not talk about it at the moment, since we might be clear later.
I thought we are doing a finite temperature transition, not the quantum transition, right?
Absolutely.
Oh, so
it's finite temperature.
This chemical potential mu tilde is not something. It's a complicated thing.
I can say that it's either complicated or simplified. So I take
I take
genuine chemical potential, but I understand that there are contributions to genuine chemical potential which are a kind of trivial set. N u, where n is the total density, just mean field contribution. I subtract it. There is one more, a little bit more subtle contribution. I also will subtract it. Okay. But I will be continuing.
Do something simple? Do I mean, I,
the temperature something I know, is U something I know, or is that also defined?
Oh, yes,
you definitely know U, because in weakly interacting gas, U is just some constant, temperature independent, whatever independent.
4 it, pi h squared.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay, so can I U and T I know, everything else is, has a Murphy definition at first practice.
Right.
T is the temperature, but I can just put
a
TC there.
And A is the S-scattering length, okay? So U is a very well-known parameter.
I can put it as TC instead of T here.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. But yeah, absolutely. But the point is that I'm going to work in the grand canonical potential and use mu as control parameter. So basically, I fix M, I fix U, I fix T. It's just a matter of convenience. So my control parameter is mu, not T. Okay.
Just as a matter of curiosity, how many new graphs you have?
Oh, I have a lot of them, but normally, actually, we're having a kind of Russian-style seminar, I see. So basically, the point is that you spent 1 hour or 50 minutes to show just two of them, and then you just...
We have so many questions.
But they are important. The rest will be just just a number of plots. So if you do not understand the beginning, the end will be just... okay. So just ask as many questions as you can, because it's just the statement of the problem. The rest will be just straightforward.
For your statement, I think we are sufficiently clever to understand the beginning. Yes.
Okay. okay, so with these estimates, we can immediately figure out the scaling of all our variables. So, first of all, we can introduce the chemical potential difference, which will be our main control parameter. So we will fix a temperature, M and U are fixed just by definition, and then we will study all thermodynamic properties as function of this main control parameter X. Of course, if we need, we can recalculate all the data in terms of, for example, temperature. But it's just a straightforward procedure, so I will not discuss it, and we'll be calculating everything as functions of this x. So our next quantity is the total density. Once again, we introduce the difference between critical density and some given density as a function of chemical potential. So
critical density is the density at which you T is that.
I fix temperature. I turn chemical potential, and at some value of chemical potential, I see the transition. And then this density, which corresponds to this transition, is what I call Nc.
So where does mu come into the calculations? Where does it appear explicitly in the calculations?
It appears in the Hamiltonian. I will describe it later. It's just the parameter of one of the parameters of the effective Hamiltonian, which we simulate. Just the parameter. Okay, the next quantity is condensate density. According to our estimates, we figure out that condensate density, when condensate appears, should be on the order typically of our M tilde, our effective density, which has nothing to do with the total density. So we scale condensate density the same way we scale our N tilde. So basically, this is the order of magnitude of our N tilde. And we arrive to the dimensionless scaling function for condensate density. And the same way we estimate superfluid density, which should be on the order, typically on the order of condensate density when we are in some typical point of fluctuation region. So you see that the scaling is the same, and we have another one, dimensionless scaling function. Now, there is some important relation. This is the relation between the actual critical density of interacting system and the density of non-interacting system. The point is that this difference is universal for all weakly interacting U1 models and is expressed only in terms of mass, temperature, and interaction. And this universal constant, you know that there were a lot of papers dealing with the temperature shift, with the interaction induced temperature shift of Bose-Einstein condensation temperature. And this temperature shift can be immediately related to this universal density shift. So it's one and the same. You can immediately recalculate this constant into the constant which describes this temperature shift. And in the year 2001, independently, our group and Arnold and Moore has accurately calculated this constant using basically the procedure which I'm going to describe by simulating the classical field. So now the issue of the critical point is known with an accuracy of, say, 3%. Yeah?
So if you re-express that result in terms of the shifting Tc constant n, you get the standard result that it goes as NAS cubed to the third.
Absolutely, 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 absolutely. Because see, this is proportional to u, and it will be proportional to u, which means that proportional to a. Absolutely. We reproduce this estimate with proper numeric coefficient. By the way, know that for some reason this constant is just small. It's on the order 100, while we would expect it to be of the order of unity. So it's just some funny numerical.
The way that most people do, that is delta Tc in terms of what is the constant that occurs in that?
1.3, as far as I remember. 1.3. And you see that if this guy would be of order 1, that constant will be of order 100. Yeah. Okay.
But this is due to the fact that you wiggle, you there is proportional. 4 pi is
absolutely.
4 pi.
Absolutely.
Squared,
yeah.
You should substitute 3.31.
Yeah.
Yes, then 3.31 in the square is 10, and 4 pi is 10. And you get the factor 100.
Great. Great. But look. Great.
That's a game of numbers.
But look. Just let's look at this from the other side. For classical lattice theory, there are no notions like S scattering length. It's just irrelevant notion for any field, classical field theory. Okay, it's the notion which deals with quantum theory, because the notion of particle, or the notion of two particles, of two colliding particles, is just senseless in any classical field. So you're right in terms of quantum field, but this is a universal result which applies to classical field as well. That's my point. So in terms of this universality, U is the crucial parameter, not A. See? Perhaps. Okay. Okay. So now let us briefly discuss the issue of universal part of the chemical potential. Actually, our chemical potential involves two perturbative terms. One of them is absolutely trivial. It's 2nu. But another one is also perturbative, and it comes from this diagram. If you will start calculating this diagram, you see that it's logarithmically divergent, but it's all perturbative. And if we introduce some lower cutoff for this diagram, we can always do that, then we will have the following answer. So this constant is just the matter of cutoff, of how we introduce cutoff. It's not interesting to go into these details. But once we have introduced this cutoff, then we can write the following expression. If we take our bare chemical potential, subtract the first perturbative term and then the second perturbative term for all weakly interacting U1 models, we will have one and the same universal function theta, which depends on the cutoff. I mean that this theta is essentially dependent with this constant. But nevertheless, up to this constant shift, this theta is a universal function, a universal dimensionless function, which describes the non-trivial universal part of the chemical potential. And the scaling coefficient, once again, comes from mass, temperature, and interaction. And in particular, at the critical point, we have the following universal relation. If we know the critical density, and we do know it for any system, then the critical chemical potential is related to this critical density and this diagram by the following universal relation. And this coefficient actually has been calculated by Arnold and Moore in the year 2001. So we know critical chemical potential as well. So everything is known in terms of the critical points, and now we would like to simulate the fluctuation region itself. So the idea is that we need to somehow simulate classical field. And basically there are two possibilities. We can do it dynamically by solving time-dependent Gross-Peter-Yevsky equation and just calculating dynamical average over some large enough time interval after thermalization of our field. Or just we can simulate the Gibbs distribution, the statistics of this field. That is, we would be using this expression for any quantity A which we would like to average. It's easy to understand that statistical simulation, provided we have a good algorithm, is always much better than dynamical simulation. Because the bottleneck of dynamical simulation is associated with most large wave numbers. And if we make some, just one sweep, we will practically have the same state of the system. Because our step in time will come from the frequencies of the most fast harmonics, which are not interesting at all. They are not interesting at all, but it's just the bottleneck for the whole simulation procedure, which means that in terms of the long wave modes, which we are interested in, the dynamic procedure is very, very slow. But
in your dynamic procedure, you would have to put in some stochastic term to account for.
No. It will be self-stochastization. You're right in terms of I start with some stochastic initial condition, and that's it. Because if I have a large enough system, it's a kind of heat bath with respect to itself. I do not need to introduce any stochastic term. But in principle, I can introduce it. It will not hurt. But even without it, the system will self-thermalize. Of course, I need to introduce some cutoff. Otherwise, the problem is ill-defined. But so I need to project this field onto just my space of harmonics. It's just a technical thing. Anyway, forget about that. It's not the way which we'll be using. It's pretty slow. So we'll be using this approach, and we will simulate the field by Monte Carlo. Moreover, we will be simulating a classical field, discrete classical field model, because for a discrete model, we have a perfect Monte Carlo algorithm. So instead of dealing with continuous classical field, we introduce the following discrete model, which is quite intuitive. This is the Hamiltonian of our discrete classical model. And we need to calculate averages like that. It's a typical average, one particle density matrix. So we need to do, yeah?
Hamiltonian, is it second line equality or approximation?
It's equality. It's exact equality. Look, what I do is look at this term.
Is that a U1 valued field, or is it just a complex number?
Psi is complex number, which lives on a site of a square lattice. So I is, and j is this site. This notation means nearest neighbor sites. So we sum over all nearest neighbor sites, and this is just the difference.
Is that equal to the expression right below it?
Absolutely, because look what happens. I just expand this square.
Oh, that's right, there's a mu prime there.
There you see mu prime, yeah? So it's this term which you are worried about is absorbed by this mu prime. Okay? So it's an equality.
Yes.
It's an equality which tells us that actually only this term is crucial in this expression. So we need to do these integrals, to do them, we use what is known as high temperature expansion. High temperature expansion is as follows. In this Hamiltonian, we see that all the terms, except for the first one, are local. These terms live on one and the same site. So if we expand this exponential just in Taylor series, we will get an expression, a sum of polynomials with respect to this size, and the whole thing can be integrated. We can integrate over all psi's, because in each expression, all terms will be factorized. All side terms will be factorized. This is the idea behind high temperature expansions. We expand exponentials, which deal with the interaction between sides. So which means that we expand this kinetic energy. We arrive at the polynomials, and then we are able to do the integration with respect to the fields. And the whole thing is a kind of series in terms of these numbers, in terms of these integer numbers, which live on the bounds of our lattice. So all our diagrams are the diagrams which expressed in terms of some integer numbers. And there are some constraints. Just without loss of generality, these constraints correspond to the fact that I can depict typical term, any term, as a kind of diagram. So if there are no arrows, this L is zero. So zero L corresponds to nothing on a bond. If I have an arrow, this arrow corresponds to L equals 1, and you see we have two terms. So the direction of the arrow corresponds to the term, either this one or another one. Actually, the representation is a little bit more subtle, but for the all practical purposes, just the universality class is defined by this constraint, that we are dealing with a kind of closed paths. And this is important, because for simulating the system of closed paths, we have a very, very efficient Worm algorithm. And this diagram is the diagram for numerator. See these two ends. One end comes from this psi, and another end comes from another psi. And the diagrams for denominator consist of only closed loops. So that's the difference. And the Worm algorithm just deals with the simulation, which involves all the diagrams, the diagrams for the numerator and denominator. And I'm just going.
Between one, the term with L equals zero is nothing. L equal one is a arrow. What do you do with two and L equal two?
It's an arrow, or it's double thick arrow, and so on. Without loss of generality, you can say that there are two arrows, three arrows, and so on. It's just a kind of cartoon.
Yes.
But
it's monotonical. So when you do the expansion, you expand the 5-4 term,
No. This term is the exponential.
Yeah.
So you can do the integral, because I integrate with respect to this psi, because it lives.
You just do numerical integration.
Absolutely. I do numerical integration. Before numerical simulation, I do numerical integration. So all the integrals are there because they are discrete numbers. So I have a list of all the integrals for all practical purposes, and go ahead. So this is the cartoon which will be explaining how Worm algorithm works. So basically, it's a Monte Carlo process. It's just some starting point. So we start just to produce the things like that. And basically, this is how algorithm works. What is important? Look, here we have a diagram for the correlator, for the denominator, because we have two ends. We call them worms, because the whole thing looks like just worm which scrolls. But at some stage of evolution, we arrive at a diagram like that, which is a diagram for denominator, which means that with one and the same simulation process, we simulate both numerator and denominator. And we always switch between this density matrix sector, which corresponds to the numerator, and partition function sector, which corresponds to the denominator. That's the main principle of the Worm algorithm. And actually, this somehow is associated with the fact that it's very, very effective. For all practical purposes, the Worm algorithm is free from critical slowing down. It's the best algorithm which we can have in principle. So now some.
I guess I don't understand the algorithm. So that the first step is what to begin to lay down.
Yeah, the first step is not important. What is important is just a kind of these steps. Yeah, so it's a Monte Carlo procedure. It goes back and forth, and at some point it saturates. It saturates, and we have some.
Let me ask my question.
Okay.
So you first lay down an arrow, and then from the tip of the arrow you go to another one, and so forth, and then
okay.
Is that how the algorithm tools? Since every time you lay down an arrow, you can evaluate the weight, and then sometimes
yeah.
So you can always start with one point, any point, and then you just
it's a standard Metropolis procedure. So what we do, we just propose to do this step. We do not accept it yet, but we just propose to do this step. Mm-hmm. Then we calculate the weight function. And according to standard Metropolis prescription, we either accept or reject. Suppose we accept, then we modify our configuration, and that's it. It's a standard Metropolis procedure. So the only non-trivial issue is that we process all the thing by moving one of the ends. Actually, we move only one of the ends. It's enough.
So sometimes then you get a closed loop, and then when you have a closed loop, you have
it's a good question. Look, what I have let me just reach some stage at which I have a closed loop. Yep. Here I have a closed loop, and at this stage I can just address to any site I want to start new one. So, for example, I can address this site, and here this new ROM appears. Okay, so this is what happens. Now, what's the difference between superfluid and non-superfluid state? Basically, in a normal state, we have a diagram consisting of small enough loops. This is the smallest one. So, in a normal state, all loops are small. In the sense that they are not macroscopic. There are no loops of the size of the system size. When we are in a superfluid state, we are dealing with loops like that. And actually, all these loops are pretty entangled. They are macroscopic and entangled. We do not... Excuse me?
What do you mean by entangled?
By entangled, I mean that you can even cannot just tell one loop of another, because you just have some structure, some looped structure. It's two-dimensional picture, but I mean that you cannot just here you can just say, okay, we have two loops, one and two. When you have some structure entangled, you just cannot unambiguously subdivide the system into just
they intersect
each other. Yeah, intersect, overlap, and so on.
So is this related to the kind of way that Semmelweis looks at it when he?
Absolutely. Because then we introduce winding number of this path, and this winding number is directly related to the superfluid stiffness. That's how we measure superfluid stiffness in terms of the winding numbers of these paths. You are absolutely right. This is the idea.
Boris, coming back to your model Hamiltonian, it just looks like a Hubbard Hamiltonian.
It would be Hubbard if psi would be annihilation operator of a particle. But my psi is a classical field. But you're right that it's a classical counterpart of Hubbard Hamiltonian.
In a functional integral method, the Hubbard Hamiltonian would be exactly the same thing with those psi's being.
Yeah, my integration doesn't involve quantumness. There are no imaginary time.
So basically the limit of the...
See what I mean? It's only zero frequency. You take quantum model, but leave only zero frequency. Then you're all classical. It's zero frequency of quantum model, which is classical.
So can we regard it as the limit of the Bose-Hubbard model with a very large number of particles per side?
Yeah, absolutely. So you take a Hubbard model with a large number of particles per site and weak enough interaction. Otherwise, no matter what is the number of particles per site, you will end up with motor insulator. motor insulator is irrelevant here because of weak interaction.
You go back one or two where you show the Hamiltonian?
Go back to the Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
Okay, let's try it. Just.
Oh, sorry.
It's perfectly okay. Just a moment. We'll go back to the Hamiltonian of what? To this?
Oh. Let's try it.
Should have a sum over, no, it should have a
next door. Next
means a sum over Aaron's neighbors.
Yeah.
Okay, so what is this business you were saying about blood covered? What was this all about in terms of this?
Excuse me?
This business you were saying about covered bottle, how does this relate to?
If I replace this psi with annihilation operator, then it will be the Hubbard model.
Okay. But this is.
And psi squared will be n of the Hubbard model, and n squared is just Hubbard.
But these are just classical fields.
But it is classical field. But if in a Hubbard model, I will have a large occupation number first and weak interaction, very weak interaction, then I will arrive to this classical limit. Classical field limit of Hubbard model. When the Hubbard model will, it's what Tony was saying, that if we take a large occupation number and then weak interaction to be away from the mode insulated transition point, okay, then we will have this limit of classical field. Because any quantum model just contains some classical field model as its limiting case, okay? So, okay, any creation annihilation operator in some limiting case can be associated with some classical mode.
So when you take the Hubbard model, Hubbard model represented as a functional integral, then you have essentially the same thing, except you have the...
But I have also imaginary time. I have imaginary time variable. In my case, there is no imaginary time. It's just the integral over... Quantum model lives, Eugene, quantum model lives in D plus 1. I live totally in D. Okay, this psi is D-dimensional, not D plus 1 dimension. Okay?
And isn't that evolution in the man? Can you think of that as evolution in the
man? No, because there is no evolution. It's not. There is no evolution. There is no evolution because psi lives in D. It's not D plus 1. There is no time whatsoever, real or imaginary.
It is the theory of D minus 1 dimension, as you said, right? So D minus 1 theory in Euclidean space is basically...
Just to put it different, it's the zeroth harmonic. So if instead of imaginary time I use discrete harmonics, it's zeroth harmonics. But just... it's a classical field. If you want to write a Gibbs distribution for a classical field, you basically write this expression. It's Gibbs distribution for classical field. That's it. It's very simple.
Oh, I know what the confusion is. If let me re-ask Eugene's question, Eugene would say that, well, suppose we are dealing with a Hubbard model,
And
then I can certainly evaluate a single part of the density matrix, epsilon I, vectors by j, in that form at finite temperature. And then since now that, so therefore as a result, I can ask the same question in what happens as I go to TC. So therefore the proper way for the, it's certainly true that the proper way to do the Hubbard model is to do the imaginary time, but somehow the imagine that population to reduce to this, and you say that it does induce to this zero frequency, and somehow so that the answer would be that somehow the zero frequency approximation is the right thing to do to determine the the TC, because we know the
proper
that's something that you
I can explain already. Absolutely, it's another way of introducing classical field. You start from all quantum model and see that the relevant mode is zero frequency mode, but then you arrive immediately to this. Yeah.
Did Arnold and Moore evaluate this as a D plus one dimensional?
Excuse me.
Did Arnold and Moore evaluate these?
No. They also we used exactly the same idea, absolutely independently. Both of us were simulating classical discrete field theory, but their Hamiltonian was a bit more subtle. They also had terms interacting like that because they wanted their Hamiltonian to take into account. They wanted to reduce these discrete corrections.
Yes.
And their method was different. They were using some cluster method. But the idea was absolutely the same, to simulate discrete classical field model.
I'm not familiar with these techniques at all, and I have a hard time connecting your arrows or your this diagram that you draw to the physics that you said on the next viewgraph, saying that when you have a large loop, how can I see that?
It was actually Tony's remark. Let me just I can provide you with the answer, but not with the explanation, because it's a kind of long story.
Okay.
So let us ask a simple question. What is the superfluid density in this formalism?
Okay.
It turns out that we can introduce some topological number. If my line goes from this point to this point, it crosses the system. Suppose I have a periodic system.
Right.
That's what is called winding number. The winding number is zero. If I have a configuration which starts here and ends here, and this is periodic, I have winding number one. I can have winding number two, and so on. And it turns out, you just need to write something, that the superfluid stiffness, which actually can be expressed as a response to the gauge field. And if you will start calculating the response to the gauge field in terms of these diagrams, you will see that each diagram depends on the gauge phase only through these winding numbers. If I introduce gauge phase here, it will not lead to any dependence of the diagram, because it will be just gauge out. You cannot gauge out only the configurations when you start here and here, when you make some complete loop around you. The gauge phase comes through non-trivial topological patterns.
So let me rephrase my. Do these arrows represent correlations? Correlations between neighboring points on your.
It's a good question. No, correlator is the statistics of these ends. Correlator describes the distribution of the distance between the ends.
Okay.
So ends themselves are not correlators, but if you just collect a histogram of all the positions of the ends, you will get this one particle correlation function. And you immediately see that to have superfluidity, we need long range order.
Right.
We need these ends be far away one from another.
Yeah.
And to have winding numbers, to have non-zero superfluid stiffness, we need infinitely large loops also. So in all cases, we need just this worm. The ends the worms to be far away one from another, macroscopically far, not microscopically. Okay? Basically, this is the language which we speak in terms of this representation. Yeah?
One question. In your initial conditions, when you choose randomly the start of a new worm, you use random phase approximation? Or
a random number generator, because there are no phases here, just random number. Put your arrow anywhere. There are no phases here, see, because it's just the issue of numbers. Because all the phases, all the fields are integrated out. We do not have our fields, our original degrees of freedom any longer, because we have integrated them out.
So then, is it true that you need more and more configurations of these to get closer and closer to the transition?
It's a good question. I would say I need large enough system, because you see that correlation radius diverges when I approach the transition. But at some stage, I will start reproducing the standard critical behavior, and I stop at this point when I see the standard critical behavior. Okay. So I need large enough cluster, but when I start seeing the universal critical behavior, the same as in liquid helium, I just say it's enough. Okay. Just not interesting any longer. Okay. I'm always working in the narrow vicinity of critical point.
No, but if you're to continue going lower in temperature, yeah. It has to be longer and longer, right?
No. Why? Because correlation length doesn't diverge when I go to zero temperature. It's finite. So when I go to zero temperature, I do not
You can only drive the critical point low unless the chemical potential is lower. Otherwise, you fix the chemical potential.
The only problem with the large system size arises in the vicinity of critical point, not at zero temperature. At zero temperature, basically, I will have a lot of errors. What happens at low temperature? I have because it's high temperature expansion. Okay, if temperature goes to infinity, I have an empty lattice in this term. If temperature is low enough, I just have a lot of errors. But the series is perfectly convergent, so there is no problem with.
More errors.
Oh, errors. I was thinking about the system. Yeah, I get more and more errors. Yeah. I will have all errors here. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I just didn't understand your question. I was thinking that you were asking me about the system size, not the errors. Okay? Yeah, you are absolutely right. Okay, so this is the first result, first numerical result for the equation of state, and actually, our time is running. So this is the result for the equation of state density as a function of temperature and chemical potential. So our temperature is fixed, and our chemical potential is just our variable. So what do we see here? We see some funny curve which demonstrates a cusp, and we could suspect that this cusp is just kind of critical. Universal critical behavior, but this cusp has nothing to do with universal critical behavior in terms of universality of, of XY model of liquid helium. Actually, the curve is pretty continuous here. It's just some very sharp crossover and nothing more, because this curve should be absolutely smooth. No cusp.
So does that mean you get a sharp change in the speed of sound?
Frankly, I don't know what stands behind this sharp cusp. What we see is that somehow the width of this crossover is almost an order of magnitude smaller than the size of the fluctuation region. Because, look, this is the mean field. Mean field breaks down here. So this is the typical size of the fluctuation region. And somehow this crossover behavior, the region of this crossover behavior is much smaller than the size of the whole fluctuation. I don't know. I don't have any explanation.
Why do you say that the equation of state should be smooth at that point?
It's we just need to go into the theory of critical phenomena, and once your critical exponent alpha is negative, you cannot have a non-smooth behavior of density. It's just a kind of theorem. So. Okay. It's a kind of theorem for the critical phenomenon. And we know that alpha, the exponent which is associated with the heat capacity, is negative in this universality class. So that's why we know that this curve should be smooth.
Aren't there some quantities that are discontinuous? Isn't the critical point defined by discontinuities and some quantity? Is it a derivative of this?
The derivative can be discontinuous. The higher order derivatives will be discontinuous. Yeah, it's not an analytic function anyway. Yeah. It's smooth but non-analytic. So this function is non-analytic.
So
you're
the first
right.
Derivative is discontinuous or the second?
The first derivative is continuous. The second may be discontinuous, and probably, but I cannot guarantee. I just do not remember. But it's some function. As always, with the second order phase transition, some derivative will be discontinuous. So you see that mean field in this region, mean field just predicts some odd behavior. It's the mean field curve is not single valued. So it's all pathological, and this is the proper curve. Okay, so we have some more results. These are the results for superfluid density and condensate density. So what do we see here? First of all, we see that at large, when we go away from fluctuation region, we have a perfect agreement with mean field theory for the weakly interacting Boltzmann or any weakly interacting U1 model. It's one and the same. So. Okay, we understand that probably we haven't made mistakes in our numeric procedure, because we reproduce a mean field behavior. And that's what happens in the fluctuation region. So this is mean field, which fails to properly describe the system. It's non-single valued. And this red curve is the critical. It's the critical curve for the given XY universality class. So it's known that this curve should be described by this critical exponent nu, which is known very well from experiments and simulations in helium. So this exponent is known. And this number is a kind of non-universal, but it is universal for all weakly interacting U1 models. So we calculate this number as well. So Zhorov and you will propose the theory which you are discussing. You should be able to reproduce this number at least. Okay. So what is interesting is that the region of this critical behavior, when we have this power law function, is much smaller than the whole fluctuation region, almost an order of magnitude smaller. So we have some region where our standard mean field fails, but we do not have a critical behavior yet. So
what happens to the red curve if you continue that?
It will go like that. It will just go away from our simulation, because it's the curve which corresponds to this exponent. And this is almost a straight line. Okay, so it will go just like that. And that's it. And the same situation with the condensate. We have a different exponent in accordance with just the theory of critical phenomena. This guy is described by different exponent. So the critical behavior. Okay. So the critical behavior of condensate differs from the critical behavior of superfluid density. Here we have another exponent, eta, and another numeric coefficient, which for some reason is close to this numeric coefficient.
Can you remind me the definition of F0 and F? Fs is super density. F0 is what?
Condensate. It's condensate density. So this is
And then Fs is?
Superfluid density. So superfluid density and condensate density are almost equal away from the fluctuation region, but has nothing to do in the critical region, okay?
So these over here and on this side, they should approach each other?
Yeah, they should approach each other in relative units, strictly speaking, in relative units, not in absolute units. Because the main term of this expansion is proportional to x in both superfluid density and condensate density. But there is the next term is different. So the expansion is first linear term, x, it's one and the same, but then goes some term like square root of x, and this second term is different for condensate and superfluid density. But the main...
Larger for condensate?
I don't remember. You can find it in our paper. Okay, I don't remember by heart which one is larger. I don't remember. I don't want to guess, okay?
The condensate and the superfluid are two separate components, and then there's a third component of other stuff?
Actually, for me, it's not easy to compare them this way, okay?
But superfluid density is defined as a response to external gauge field.
Absolutely. A condensate density is defined as the limit of single particle density matrix. So when I take correlator far away from another, I reach condensate.
So if I'm close to say the superfluid density matrix greater than
According to this exponent, yeah, I have this positive eta, which means that this exponent is a little bit larger than nu, a little bit, because this is a pretty small nest coefficient. Okay, but formally they have nothing to do one with another. Okay.
Exponential.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
How do you extract F0 from the simulation?
I just measure the zero Fourier component of my correlator. It's by definition, F0 is the zero Fourier component of my correlator. I just measure it and extract.
Do you happen to know, is there a general theorem which says that the superfluid fraction always has to be larger than or equal to the condensate fraction?
I'm not sure, because basically it depends on the region, and it depends on the region, and we can discuss it, because it looks like in 2D and 3D we are I cannot say anything about the relation between two, because look, All both are some asymptotic properties of the system. Both of them come from some microscopic quasi-condensate behavior, but then there is a suppression of quasi-condensate by fluctuation of phase. So actually, frankly, I cannot relate one to another. So they are so different. So it's an interesting question, but I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer, whether there is some answer which would relate just.
I think one is the two odd known cases, one is that I know of, is true that the superdensity is higher. And second, I wonder whether the Joseph
I can give you some example. It's not made. I will give an example when superfluid density can be much lower than condensate density. But the example may be...
It's not a cheap. I think if there's some lock-up in solid layer, that's what I think that doesn't count.
Excuse me? No. If the system is non-homogeneous... Then you can have arbitrarily low superfluid density just because of narrow channels, narrow Jesus and perfect condensate because the system is 3D. So I think that there is no universal answer.
Even three-dimensional free space.
Yeah. So I think that there is.
I think for homogeneous system, there must be a universal answer.
Look, any inhomogeneous system can be represented as a limit of some homogeneous system with some slowly varying mode of some.
Let's move on.
Okay. But anyway, it goes away from fluctuation region. Okay. Okay. Let me finish just with the main part, and we'll continue.
I may have missed this, but how do you exactly define condensate density?
Superfluid density is defined in terms of winding numbers, in terms of their response to the gauge phase, and condensate density is defined. I just take this correlator. R is a discrete variable, and just integrate it over all R's, and I get zero Fourier component. I get zero Fourier component, and I relate it to my condensate. Okay, so basically it's all about this sort of data, and this is just the comparison. Previously, we have performed the same calculation in 2D, and look, in 2D we saw the following. This is the mean field curve, the quasi-condensate mean field curve, and this is the critical Coster-Thouless curve, which basically corresponds to the square root behavior. This curve is a square root, and this is the universal jump. And basically, this solid line is an analog of this critical red line, of course, with a different power law behavior. This is square root power law behavior plus jump. And we saw in 2D that basically there is no gap between mean field and Coster-Thouless behavior. One just starts immediately after another. Just this mean field and Coster-Thouless curve just cover all the region. Yeah, this is nice, and here we have absolutely different situation. We have a gap, because mean field will start working only somewhere here, while critical behavior is good only in this region.
It's not wise, because nobody expects mean field to work better in higher dimensions.
Yeah. Excuse me?
Nobody expects mean field to work better in higher dimensions.
I think this region is not, this line, we'll assume, is critical, right?
It's critical.
The only dotted line, I think this is pretty far away.
Actually, in 2D, fluctuations are strong in this region. So somehow, fluctuations in 2D are strong here. If you approach the system from the normal, side, the fluctuations are strong and everything okay with them. Maybe the explanation is that the superfluid transition actually is driven by relatively small fugacity of pairs. because basically the transition is driven just by vortex pairs. So there are no.
Tony, I think scale is misleading. Yeah. It's 1, 3. Actually, it's much narrower than the size of that. Never mind.
Okay. Okay.
But in the 2D fluctuations, usually the fluctuation between is basically determined by the number of particles within the context.
Fluctuations in any case are fluctuations in the absolute value of the order parameter. But what happens here is maybe the absolute value of order parameter in 2D doesn't fluctuate strongly yet, but the superfluidity is destroyed already by some small, numerically small, there are no just letter parameters, concentration of dissociated vortex pairs. See, I have a dilute gas of pairs, of vortex pairs, but there, I do not have superfluidity any longer, because just...
I understand. But that's definition. I'm saying that to get an estimate of the width of fluctuation in 2D,
yeah.
I guess it's simply the number of particles within the coherent space, the square of the coherent space. That would be the estimate.
The
usually is shifted a little bit from the, away from the weak theory. And usually it's not a problem because in the weak impact limit that shift is very small. At least that's the case for superconductor. I mean, just for some two dimensional just for some junctions. Sorry, it's also the case here.
So your point,
shift between the mean field.
I see. So you mean that mean field critical point will be where? Here?
It's always shifted, but the shift is very small.
What is a question, a comment? What's your point?
My point is there's the shift, and the mean field should be shifted away from KT critical point. And
the amount of shift is exactly the size of the fluctuation region, because it cannot be shifted further than the fluctuation region.
Which is the number of particles within the coherent space?
The estimate is basically the same as in 3D. I could just do the same estimates in 2D, and we did actually them. So basically replace D equals 3 with D equals 2, and you will get exactly the same estimate in terms of mode coupling radius, which will be a kind of Hilling length, and so on. So you will end up with the same estimate.
Yeah. I mean, I'm saying, though the low temperature fluctuation, the low temperature phase, the fluctuation is much stronger than the mean field. The shift actually is not that big.
Okay. So anyway, maybe actually this is the quasi condensate mean field, which is equivalent to two orders of ordinary mean field. Maybe it's possible just to do a better job and to calculate some more terms in the regular diagrammatic expansion and to have just a perturbative curve going like that. It's just this challenge to you, Jara. Okay, now let's discuss what can be seen experimentally. Actually, this is a density profile. I can end up in 5 minutes. If there are no questions, I end up in 3 minutes. Okay. So this is the density profile defined for the gas parameter when Na cubed is 10 to the minus 6. So naively, we would say it's a very small gas parameter. But we see a significant difference in density profiles if we use mean field description of the density profile. It's a harmonic trap. RT is just the temperature radius. The radius corresponds just the size of the thermal cloud. So we see a very strong deviation of actual curve from the mean field curve. And even in the case when the condensate density is already large enough, we have large enough condensate density, all this difference is due to fluctuations. And in principle, if it would be possible to resolve just density profile, because just resolving this critical density shift is just density shift is just an unfortunate quantity, because for some numeric reason the position of this point, which corresponds to the ideal gas, and this point with the actual point corresponds to one and the same basically density. So, but
what
if
was the blue curve again, I missed that.
Blue curve,
yeah,
is the condensate. This is the total density.
I see.
And this is the condensate, because you always want to know how many condensate do we have. So we have a pretty good fraction of condensate here. But still we have a strong deviation from the actual between the actual profile and the profile predicted by mean field theory. And my next point will be that
the red curve go down to where?
It approaches mean field, because away, look, here we have a fluctuation region, and here we go away from fluctuation region because chemical potential increases.
So it goes to 0 at 1 on this scale.
Yeah,
right?
Look, yeah. So at r equals 0, we have the following x. But when we go away, we just change the chemical potential. We change our x because I can, basically, this is x. In a sense, it's x because it's local density approximation, quasi homogeneous approximation. We just use our homogeneous result in a quasi-homogeneous local density sense. So we go away from fluctuation region here, and then red curve approaches this mean field curve, and that's it. Nothing special.
This temperature is not that close to the critical temperature.
Our temperature just is fixed.
Yeah, but here it's not that close.
In which sense? Yeah, well, so what? So what?
Yeah,
so what?
Are you working at a temperature close to critical temperature for the central density?
Yeah.
No, because the central, you see, total density and the condensate density differ by half.
Yeah. My point is, I will explain you everything. Actually, this the point is that this gas parameter, which you think that this gas parameter is very small.
Right.
My point is that it's of order unity, and I will explain you why. So this system is not a weakly interacting system at all. It's close to the situation when it becomes strongly interacting.
What's your system exactly? 3D gas, how many particles?
Whatever. This answer is not in terms of particles. It's in terms of universal
problems. Giving variables, so that will.
Oh, that's the problem.
This is just taking a uniform answer and plot it, assuming local
density approximation. It's just local density approximation.
But then why should I expect this is a good approximation? Because I know that the coherence.
You need to take a loose enough trap. That's the problem. That's the experimental challenge. It's not just any trap. It's a trap in which you can use local density approximation.
Yeah, and then what exactly is that condition?
This condition means that all the variation is slow in comparison to the correlation radius.
So,
yeah.
So DTC is gigantic.
If I'm at some temperature which is not particularly close to T, and I ask what is the distribution in a harmonic trap, don't I find that the condensate is all picked up in a rather small region near the origin, and the normal compartment is spread over a much wider region?
This region is quite narrow, because here you have 0.1, which means the typical size of the normal component is 10 times larger. So see this 0.1. So condensate forms a narrow peak. It's 10 times wider than the normal component.
What I'm not understanding is why you don't, more as well, discontinuous drop in your density profile.
It's not a drop, it's just the part of the curve. I'm not interested in this part. There is a continuation of this curve, but it's a kind of trivial. I just draw the situation in the trap center. See, it's not a drop. It's just the line which goes like that. My distribution looks like that. It's a typical plot which looks like that. But I draw just this portion of the curve. because I'm interested only in this behavior. Behavior here is a kind of trivial. It's just mean field behavior.
What is RT? Is that the thermal?
It's the thermal, yeah.
Yeah, so it's when it was growing.
Oh, okay.
So it goes on forever. It goes on 10 times forever.
Whereas your mean field solution, you see, comes to this side and then goes on. I mean, what is, there's this little needle thing.
Excuse me?
He's worried about the multi-valued part.
Yeah. This?
Yeah.
Because mean field solution here is all wrong. It's pathological, okay? It doesn't work here. Mean field solution, if you will take mean field solution, you will see that it predicts a kind of first order phase transition. This means that mean field solution is senseless here.
But mean field with the trap, using trap space is not a problem.
It is a problem because you will get this answer.
No, that's
you will show me how can you look in local density approximation. Density is local. This is the mean field.
I'm not saying don't do the local density approximation. You do the calculation mean field with the trap states.
But if your trap is loose, whatever you are going to do will end up with the local density approximation.
Well, presumably it won't be at the edge, right? At the edge of the
But we are discussing the center, at the center of a loose trap. Whatever you are doing, there is no edge. It's edge of my box, not the edge of the system.
You're worried about the edge of the condensate. Where that
here?
Yes, that's what you're worried about, right?
Oh no. The edge of the condensate here is a specific point. This edge comes from numerics. Mean field will give you the behavior like that.
Yeah, whatever your mean field is based on the LDA.
If you start the mean field, just generic mean field in a trap, and it will take your trap loose enough, you inevitably will end up with a local density approximation. It's just impossible because you are working with eigenstates, single particle eigenstates, and a loose trap, there will be.
I don't believe it.
And it's, for me, it's a kind of surprise. Why don't you believe it? Because it's just self-evident.
Because you take a harmonic trap and you just calculate.
And end up with the local density.
You will then occupy those states thermally. You will not have this problem.
Yeah, that's what I agree with.
Just show me your calculations, okay?
No, it's true, but then the question is, the question is how good are the Hadron Bob maneuver of near the critical region? That's the issue.
If I have a kind of narrow trap, there is no criticality whatsoever. I will have discrete harmonics.
I think that if I understand properly, the argument is not whether mean field Hartree-Fraunhofer is good or bad, it's whether it produces a multi-valued solution. That's really your question, right?
It does, and for the homogeneous gas, but I don't believe it's going to be true.
That's what I mean.
But check. You don't believe, but check. Just go ahead, check. Just write me something. Your point is you don't believe.
Let me interject. Eugene's statement, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, is based on the Hadron-Fraunhofer calculation, and then the question then becomes that whether I can extend this calculation, this validity of the calculation extends when I open up the trap, will gradually make it a homogeneous system, because eventually I can go to that limit. So at some point, the Hadron-Fraunhofer would have to break down because it's inevitably near the critical region. There's nevertheless an approximation. The reason that is good because at the beginning is that there is in the trap you introduce a gap, but that gap gradually closes up as I open the trap, so therefore it would be in trouble again.
No, it's not only a gap, it's also when you sum up the states against your states.
Okay, I'm ready to answer your question. In Hartree-Fock-Bogoliubov, in this regime, it's condensate is not just described by a separate equation, there is n prime term, okay? And this this n prime term makes difference because your problem, I would say, is not, in my opinion,
n prime is
a thermal excitation. But thermal excitation itself depends on the condensate density.
Right.
So you have a nonlinear system of equations. You do not just have a single Gross-Pitayevsky equation isolated from the rest of the world.
Right.
You have a system of coupled, essentially nonlinearly coupled,
yes,
equations. Gross-Pitayevsky gross Pitayevsky plus this n prime term, and n prime, which itself depends on n naught.
Right. Yeah.
And then I'm not sure at all that the solution is unique.
It's unique. Yeah. Several groups have solved it.
I think this is because you use the local density. I mean, so it's a homogeneous theorem.
But okay. So I agree. So okay.
Do we say that Hartley von Bogoliubov works well at the criticality that it describes critical phenomena?
No. It's unique. That means you solve it.
Okay.
It does not give you.
Okay. Okay. I agree that probably you will produce something like that. So you, this portion will be absent, but it's okay with me.
And this portion will get sharper and sharper if the trap opens up with the bug, the hatching bug. I mean, the fact that you understand the reason why it works in a trap and why it doesn't work in a homogeneous system. Mm-hmm. That once you begin to address a question, you know the problem.
Okay. I agree with you because it's absolutely okay that instead of doing this, it will go like that. There will be something coming from this gradient term. But once again, that is.
I'm not sure in the exactness of your Bogoliubov-Hartree focal approach before you do the exact calculation like they did.
No, but that's not the argument.
They say something good about bad about Bogoliubov-Hartree focal when you do the exact calculation.
But that was not the point of the discussion. The point was, does Hartree focal Bogoliubov give this Berti value or not?
Oh, okay. I can agree. I can easily buy the fact that Hartree focal Bogoliubov, instead of doing this, will go like that and then like that.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's
too bad.
It's too bad, yeah? Okay, so.
One more question. The red curve is the total density profile?
Yeah, it's the total density profile.
What's happening at
here?
Is it real or?
Cusp? I was saying that actually it's a smooth curve, it's not a cusp. You mean this point?
So do you have big arrow bars there or what?
Here? No arrow bars.
I see the cusp, you're saying there's no cusp.
But if you blow it up,
if I blow it up, it will be a smooth curve.
I understand. Still, on this scale, there is some feature there.
Yeah, and this feature is a kind of just, it is here. It's here. No. Arrow bars are pretty small because I was showing you the plot. Oh, that is. Oh, excuse me. Look, these are our error. Yeah, there is feature. So
it's
what? I have no idea.
Sure, the condensate forms, and that's why you have that.
Yeah, but this feature is just there is some feature. It's all okay. Explain it to me, and I will be grateful to you.
Okay,
I'm just naive. What's that?
Gentlemen, it's 11:44. I propose we better.
Okay. In this sense, I'm just a naive experimentalist. I just produce something. So this is the estimates which show that actually this interaction is not small enough. Here we numerically define this Cas-C to a good approximation up to a factor of order unity. This is the numeric result, this factor of 3 is the numeric result for what Kc is. So then we need a condition that this Kc should be much smaller than Kt. Otherwise, we do not have this universality. We cannot cut our system into two pieces. And we immediately arrive at the condition that we can apply all this description, which I was telling you about, only when this gas parameter is much smaller than this number. So actually, what was shown on the previous plot corresponds to just quite significantly interacting system. On the previous plot, a n to the power 1/3 was on the order of was equal. Excuse me. Okay, so I was just showing you that the strong effect which we are observing comes from this effect that in the vicinity of the fluctuation region, the parameter should be actually very, very small to demonstrate this universal U1 behavior. Otherwise, quantum corrections will be significant.
Or is it, if I try to reformulate, can I say that it should be that small so you can use your
Classical field description. Otherwise, I need to take into account quantization of my field. I can forget about quantization only when the gas parameter is that small. Otherwise, I cannot. Otherwise, I need to take into account the quantization of harmonics. And the very last point just is that the quasi-condensate mean field is better than condensate mean field. So what is quasi-condensate? We subdivide our field into two components. One is just the standard component, and another is quasi-condensate, or the following form. We have some absolute value, which is constant, and fluctuation phase. And this is the relation between genuine condensate and quasi-condensate. Genuine condensate differs, it's smaller than quasi-condensate because of this extra suppression due to the phase fluctuations. When we approach fluctuation region, these phase fluctuations are actually the most dangerous mode, the most soft mode. So it's a good idea to take them into account. Because if you look at this expression, we immediately will and make some estimates, we immediately will see that the difference between quasi-condensate and condensate scales at a square root of x as we go away from the critical region, which means that we have a significant difference. And this is just the example. So blue points are our Monte Carlo data. This purple curve is the quasi-condensate mean field based on the quasi-condensate. Actually, yeah?
This expectation value has a well-defined limit as R goes to infinity?
Yeah, because we are in 3D. In 2D, there is no limit, but we are in a 3D, okay? In a 3D case.
And then for...
Okay?
Because we just need to get rid of all the low-lying, non-magnetic explosions.
So this is this line corresponds to the just a very simple condensate mean field when we just take the first order terms in the condensate mean field, and this line corresponds to the same expressions which we use with condensate mean field, but when condensate is replaced with quasi condensate, and we see perfect agreement. Basically, if we look at the results which we can see in literature for the second order corrections to the behavior of the system, we will immediately realize that these corrections are nothing else than the corrections which correct condensate to quasi-condensate. To get these corrections, we can just take first order terms and replace, for example, in Bogoliubov spectrum, the condensate density with quasi-condensate density. And then we immediately get in the first order the same result as we get in the second order, which we start with a genuine condensate. And physically we understand why, because actually condensate corresponds to some long-range behavior. Well, the spectrum should be defined by some local properties of the system, not long-range. It's a kind of double counting. We introduce condensate, but we are kind of count twice because of these fluctuations of the phase. So it's just the message that in 3D it's a good idea to use quasi-condensate when constructing mean field.
Okay. Is quasi-condensate just multiplying the condensate by some?
No. You use your quasi-condensate is your basic variable, basic local variable which describes your spectrum, which enters the Bogoliubov spectrum. And you calculate genuine condensate using this formula. So this is the main main variable of your theory, and the rest comes from it. Superfluid density comes from quasi-condensate. Condensate density comes from the quasi-condensate.
Yes, and eventually, when I get closer to the critical region, I have to consider density fluctuation also. So there would be another factor that to do.
There will be, and this curve.
This depends with quasi-condensate because. But there is a systematic thing, but it already shows how good it is once you take the first step without density fluctuation, the phase fluctuation is already taking a lot.
Yeah.
You take you very wide into the.
Just the message is base all your theory on quasi-condensate, not condensate, and you will much better off with just with you will get everything in the first approximation rather than in with the next terms. because in terms of relative errors, we of course will be converging. Okay, so these are the conclusions. So basically, the conclusion is that everything is calculated. Thank you for your attention.
So I have a question.
Wait, a question. I should say that last year, I think somehow Tony was able, well, last 5 years ago, Tony was able to keep the time much more precisely.
I took a lesson from Mark Katz. I just took the microphone off the speaker.
Sorry, question, please.
So have you done simulations in the regime where A and one third is much less than what you did? And if yes, do you get a better agreement with the Minfield theory?
Actually, A is an irrelevant quantity
A and one third.
Let me explain that we were simulating. It's the result. This quantity is meaningful only for quantum system. There is no such a quantity as a scattering length for a classical field system. Only U. What we were doing, we were taking U smaller and smaller until we saturate to some curves which become U independent. We check that our result are U independent. What we were extracting U independent result, not just taking some U and plotting some curves. We were checking that the result saturates, that all the curves collapse to some U independent curve. That's what we were doing, of course, as you know. But it is a standard Monte Carlo technique, just taking the limit and finite size analysis. Just you basically we check two issues, that our results are U independent and independent of the system size. Okay.
May I suggest that we should we can continue our question sessions and during lunch. It's several people and has been looking at me in the direction. So I formally declare this.
Okay, which slide?
Oh, the one, the quasi-condensate one.
Yeah, people were explaining we didn't use the how nice effects that the rules and effects
of so the idea is that instead of reducing the problem to just a classical field, I should reduce it to a classical field plus a Goldstone mode.
Instead
of integrating up the Goldstone mode, treat it as another degree of freedom. And so
yeah, to put it different, we need to use the same approach we use in 2D, because in 2D there is no genuine condensate, and we have an approach in terms of quasi-condensate.
Yes.
So just use the same equation. Basically, what we did, we took my relations, which I was obtaining in my PhD thesis for two-dimensional gas, and just replaced 2D with 3D, and that's it.
No, I got it wrong. I thought usually
this is condensate.
Usually,
will
these lines,
spherical
Tarnoff,
are these lines diverge? No, they diverge as square root of x. In absolute sense, they diverge as square root of x. But in relative sense, they converge. Look.
Way down here is this? The chemical potential is not intuitive to me. So what? This is the phase transition, and here I'm going down to the pure condensate.
Yeah. But absolutely.
This way is the pure condensate.
Yeah.
When I have zero, the pure condensate at zero temperature is.
Zero temperature is very, very away from this because it's at infinity. Zero temperature is at infinity.
Okay, but at zero temperature, what effect does this have?
Oh, at zero temperature, you need only quantum fluctuations survive. So it's not for zero temperature. It's for large enough temperature.
It will not do any harm at zero temperature, right?
No, it will not. Yeah.
But at zero temperature, if you do this,
I'm okay. It will not do any harm.
And the condensate will equal the quasi-condensate.
Yeah. Absolutely.
If you want to improve the description as you approach the critical point, this improves.
It takes into account density fluctuations of the phase. But it will thermal phase fluctuation, because there are also quantum phase fluctuations, but they're not that strong. But thermal phase fluctuations are important. They lead to this difference, this square root difference. So the, in terms of absolute difference, it becomes progressively larger.
This gap is expanding.
Yeah. The gap is but in relative units, it becomes smaller as one of the square root of x, because the main term is linear. Mm-hmm. The correction is square root.
That corresponding with that, but in the trap, I never have that.
Okay.
This thing confines.
Very nice talk. It's really very enjoyable.
Thank you very much. So.